This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Everyone knows Charlotte is among the fastest growing regions in the country. Everyone knows this. They know it in Washington, they know it in Raleigh, and we certainly know it here. And for years, we've been talking about various means of controlling the congestion that necessarily comes with growth and the influx of the people that it brings. Well, the answer isn't just building or widening roads. You can't afford to build or widen them fast enough, and even if you could, they would fill up with cars as fast as you could build them. Roads are only part of the solution. One light rail project isn't going to solve the problem either, though it's been highly successful on its own. No, what we need is a transportation system, one where all the pieces have a purpose and fit together to run like a well-oiled machine. But every time someone brings up an idea about one or two pieces of that system, a toll road, a streetcar, commuter rail, there is reluctance to fund the projects in Raleigh, and there is usually an uproar from one corner of the city or another about the proposal being a bad idea. People are, in fact, working on a transportation system, but rolling out projects one at a time is like staring at puzzle pieces scattered on a table. It's hard to see how the pieces fit together, so today we thought we'd make an attempt to see the bigger picture. Ned Curran is chair of the board of the North Carolina Board of Transportation. He is also president and CEO of the Bissell Companies and incoming chair of the Charlotte Chamber. He joins us in our Spirit Square studio again this morning. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mike.
He's here with Mary Newsom, Craig Lewis, and John M. Lewis, Jr. Mary is Associate Director of Urban and Regional Affairs at the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute and a longtime local journalist. Thanks for joining us again.
Glad to be here.
Craig Lewis is a principal with the international design consulting firm Stantec, which helps public, private, and nonprofit clients understand the benefits of walkable downtowns, neighborhoods, and suburban centers. He's not here to talk on behalf of his company, however. He's here to share his personal expertise on this matter. Welcome.
Good morning.
And John M. Lewis just arrived in Charlotte in September to become chief executive of Charlotte Transit System, CATS. Aside from building the Lynx Blue Line out to the university and expanding platforms to accommodate longer trains, he's working on advancing the city's long-term transit plan. Thank you for being here as well. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Welcome to Charlotte. You are the chair, Ned, of 19 men and women from around the state who make up this board of transportation and meet monthly to talk about transportation issues. Does that board have any official power, or is it merely advisory?
It's advisory, and it's a policy board. So we look at things like you talk about systems and the plans that are associated with them. Every 2 years, we adopt a transportation improvement plan that's all over the state. Comes forth from planning organizations, regional planning organizations, metropolitan planning organizations. Those plans embrace all modes. I think this will be a fascinating discussion as we talk about how comprehensive it is, how detailed it is. I think we've come a long way in terms of embracing multiple modes, mm-hmm. but we have a long way to go.
So when your board gets together and comes up with policies and procedures and you're advising, who are you advising? NCDOT or the legislature or the governor or municipalities? Who are you talking to?
All of the above. Each of the board members has voting powers within the regional planning organizations or MPOs themselves. So your job is not just to collectively meet as 19 members, but also within your particular regions or jurisdictions that you have responsibility for.
I guess because we're the fastest growing city in the Carolinas, and Raleigh is pretty close to us, but we have long felt neglected by Raleigh in terms of infrastructure here. I don't know if that's justified or not, but I-77 has long been a frustration for people who have to drive it every day. When 485 opened through Pineville, we thought this was going to be a panacea, and it turned out to be another road that is clogged with traffic during rush hours in both directions. And other areas of the state, it is our impression in this part of the world that other areas of the state don't have to beg Raleigh for road money. They have good roads. We don't. Why?
Yeah, I think it's a legitimate expression to say that high-growth urban areas, Raleigh, Charlotte, some other areas, Asheville, have been challenged to get a fair share of the resources. I think that has changed dramatically in the last 3 years. The legislature and the governor enacted a new law in 2013 that changed dramatically the way we appropriate monies. and it's more database now. We've tried to take the elected official, the board member, the governor, out of the influence that they had. So some of the roads that people would complain about, where they say they drive and see roads to the appearance of roads to nowhere, you know, those might have been where a powerful legislator mm-hmm. was, or something along those lines. That's really changed. Today we debate the merits of data sets. How important is walkability? How important is congestion and safety and cost benefit analysis? So that systems are more about the need and the relative need relative to other parts of the state. We have limited funding. So what's the best way to allocate dollars around the state? There are checkpoints on how much money can be appropriated to any one thoroughfare. So that perhaps the I-77 North Corridor is the most congested corridor in the state, and it is one of them. But at the same time, we don't have enough money for it to absorb all the money across the state. So I think we are in a better mode. Every 2 years, we revise the data set. So now when we get together, we don't talk about, you know, Craig, you get a road and I get a road, which is kind of the old system. Today we talk about how much value, how much should we appropriate into a category that would be for non-highway modes. You know, so I think it's a much more refined type of discussion.
I think around the country we're going through this paradigm shift, and I think probably the millennials are driving a lot of this because they don't care about cars, and they want to live in urban areas, and they want to be able to walk to work. They want to be able to walk to their friends. They want to be able to walk to restaurants. That's a whole different thing than what most of the country, including Charlotte, has been designed to do. And I guess because we're living through this and because Charlotte is actually becoming a city as opposed to a big small town, when ideas are floated, they're met with some derision. When Ron Tober was working on building the bus system into a better bus system, people said, why bother? Nobody rides the bus. When we proposed the light rail, people called it a boondoggle. The trolley was derided for a long, long time. Now the streetcar is highly controversial. The toll lanes on I-77 are despised. Is this par for the course? Is this what's going on around the country as we begin to consider the need for multimodal forms of transportation as opposed to just concentrating on the car?
No, there's no question about it.
Mary, you're shaking. You're nodding your head.
I'm nodding my head. Going back to your discussion about the millennials, it's not just millennials. I was talking to an AARP official on Monday who pointed out that boomers, as the big boom generation retires, they want the same things, a mm-hmm. lot of them, as millennials. So you've got two ends of the generational spectrum wanting those things. I think nowhere in America do people want their taxes to go up, and transportation is really expensive. And in places that have had large transit systems for decades, you know, Boston, New York, you know, I think the taxpayers, they still don't want their taxes to go up, but they understand the value that the transit system brings. So they whine about the taxes maybe, but they don't whine about the existence of the transit. And we're still going through that transition here.
I actually had a question about that that I was going to ask much later, but you brought it up. Let's ask it now. New York, Boston both have subway systems that they built 100 years ago or more. The Chicago has the L. Los Angeles has a system, I believe, certainly the BART in San Francisco. Was there hue and cry at the beginning of the 20th century, the late 19th century, when New York decided it was going to build subways, when Boston decided it was going to build a subway? Did people see it as a boondoggle? Did they complain about rising taxes? Was it built with public dollars? Was it built with private dollars? How did it work? How did they – because back then, New York was not what New York is today. It was what Charlotte is today, maybe a little bigger.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's one of the key considerations, is that it was built in a different time when costs were different and expectations were different.
Yeah, but costs were – it was always expensive to build.
It was always expensive, but when we built a lot of our early transit systems, they were built on immigrant labor mm-hmm. And the expectations for how they were to perform.
Aren't they today?
Well, in some – well, and that's an interesting part of the conversation because our transit systems are the most expensive in the world. And we continue to have a conversation about building transit systems which are predicated upon how much we can spend, but not about how much they actually cost to build. And when we start talking about the broader conversation about infrastructure being more and more expensive and transit being one of the most expensive forms of that, it's always about – how much we're ultimately, what's the top line price tag on it, and not about trying to figure out how we can innovate to build more effective, leaner, more efficient transit systems.
Why, it sounds like medicine all over again, why are our systems the most expensive in the world? Because our costs for labor are the highest?
Well, I think we've got a couple things that are in there, and I heard one of our congressmen not unapologetically talking about that recently, is that we have a lot of lawyers in this country, so that automatically drives the cost of our liability. Mm-hmm. And so we have basically over-engineered our transit system. And we also have costs of labor, which are probably the highest in the world, that people view very much as building jobs. And they don't want to get rid of those jobs because they're good, high-paying jobs at the time, but they factor into the cost of things.
It's also very challenging to make investments for the future. So right-of-way acquisition sometimes can be very prohibitively expensive. Yesterday, I toured several acres that NCDOT purchased years ago for a corridor right down Tryon Street for the new Gateway station that'll be in Charlotte. And it's fascinating that where the train station was, the main station in Charlotte in 1898, is where the Greyhound station is today, and that is where we're going to put the new Gateway station.
Is that because that's where it makes sense, or is that because we already own it?
No, we actually are acquiring the Greyhound station as we speak, but where it makes sense.
And that's where, the streetcar will stop and the buses will stop and if we get commuter rail, it will terminate?
Correct.
There? Well, here's a question. It's nowhere near the light rail. How is that a system?
Well, that's why we are making the investment in streetcar. And I think exactly how you described it earlier, we can't look at these as individual projects. We have to look at these as part of a system, a mobility system that provides many different modes and options for our commuters. The light rail does not go there because the light rail is a north-south line. Mm-hmm. But the streetcar will pass by there and have access to that. So individuals will be able to come from the suburbs into uptown, connect to streetcar very seamlessly, get onto light rail or other bus to make their last mile connections. And so we have to think of this as a system of mobility options.
And I just wanted to say that it's actually not that far. It's probably 5 blocks.
Yeah.
I was sitting here on my fingers trying to count.
But 5 blocks is longer. It's a longer distance than Grand Central Station, where you get off a train and you can get a subway or you can get a bus.
Exactly.
Right,
but
there in the same place.
In New York, if you want to walk 5 blocks, it's no big deal.
Right.
In Charlotte, we are just not used to a pedestrian fabric.
And we're looking at alternatives when you come in from, say, the east side, where there may be a transfer opportunity, where you can get off the commuter rail or the rail coming in from Raleigh and jump on a line that would take you onto the light rail. So,
is part of the problem here is that was I accurate in saying that part of the problem with people understanding this or getting on board with this, the fact that they only see the puzzle pieces and they don't see the whole plan, is that part of the problem?
People think about what affects them. So it's what my regular commute is. That's what I see. I don't necessarily see the total system. I don't necessarily see that my employer, you talked about urbanization and Mary, the fact that people do want to be closer. They want to be in areas where there's walkability. Much of what they want is within a 2 or 3 mile radius. But even if you don't own a car, you are relying on the transportation system. If you're ordering things on Amazon or things like that, you're relying on a transportation system.
So when we come back, I want to talk about this plan a little bit because there are I asked a question about this just before we went on the air, and evidently there are lots of plans. So I want to find out which plan we're following and where it will take us when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and UNC's Gilling School of Global Public Health, offering GOMPH, the Global Online Master of Public Health Program. More at sph.unc.edu/GOMPH1. And Discovery Place, presenting Body Worlds and the Cycle of Life, the new exhibition with over 100 real human specimens that reveals the body throughout the human life cycle from birth to aging. Tickets at discoveryplace.org. Rit Nahara is almost white. That's his way of saying he's Latino. A performer, he noticed that Hispanics were underrepresented on television, so he decided to do something about it. Realizing that writers control the ethnicity of TV characters, he started writing more roles for non-whites. And he joins us to talk about that and his book, Almost White, Forced Confessions of a Latino in Hollywood tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Donald Trump's call to ban Muslims from entering the U.S. has touched off a rift within the Republican Party. What the split between the base and party leaders means for the future of the GOP and the 2016 presidential race.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about transportation in Charlotte and the transportation system plan, where all these disparate pieces will hopefully come together and make sense to everyone, with Ned Curran, who's chair of the North Carolina Board of Transportation, Mary Newsom, associate director of urban and regional affairs at UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute, Craig Lewis as a principal at Stantec. They are an advisory firm on these issues, but he's here to talk from his own personal expertise, and John M. Lewis, Jr., is CEO of CATS. Now, just prior to our starting on the air, I asked about which plan we're following, because there are a number of plans, including the 2030 plan, the Transit Corridor System plan, and you very quickly pointed out, John, that that is a CATS plan. That's the plan for CATS. That's not the overall system plan. So what plan, what system are we building out? What plan details the system that we're talking about these pieces of? If that makes any sense.
it does. I think there are municipality plans. The city of Charlotte has plans for transit as well as other transportation systems. At the statewide level, we're very reliant on metropolitan planning organizations or regional planning organizations, which are part of a federal mandate.
And we have several here in this region, right?
We do. Those organizations will have anywhere from 2, 5, 7, 10, 20, and 40-year plans. So you're looking out in a very far-reaching manner, and then you're into the nit-grit of what are we doing in the next 2 to 5 years.
You may not know the answer to this question. Somebody at the table might. Maybe Mary, I don't know, because she studies all of this. But do all these plans, do they agree? If you put them all together, and whether they're a 20-year plan or a 30-year plan or a 40-year plan, is the goal the same?
I'm going to confess, I have not read them all.
Okay. Well, who could?
My guess is that they're all in favor of a strong and connected transportation system, okay, and that they get a little fuzzy on the details and the funding.
Well, now, the 2030 Metropolitan Transit Commission plan, the 2030 Transit Corridor System plan for the region for CATS, states that once it is implemented, we will have 25 miles of commuter rail, 21 miles of light rail, 16 miles of streetcar, 14 miles of bus rapid transit, and an expanded network of buses and other transit services. This is the 2030 plan. It's 2015. We have 15 years to go. Are we on track? And I know you just got here in September, but are we on track?
Well, we have accomplished a great deal of that plan. The Blue Line has been in operation. We're in the midst of constructing the extension of the Blue Line to University of North Carolina, Charlotte. Mm-hmm. The streetcar was not a part of that original plan, but has been added to the system. We're in discussions about Charlotte Gateway Station and the multimodal benefits that will give. But we haven't. We still have some challenges, and the biggest challenges are financial challenges. When we began, and leaders in this community took that heavy lift and developed that plan and added the funding that was necessary to achieve that plan, nobody thought that knew that the Great Recession was happening in the very near horizon. That really was a slap in the face. It made us all step back and reevaluate how we do business, no matter what business you're in. And we are lacking in the necessary funding to complete the plan as it is constructed right now. We are right now working with the Metropolitan Commission to reevaluate that and figure out what is the best means of achieving that overall goals of that plan.
But recession or not, the Blue Line, and then Mayor McCrory took a lot of heat for being a proponent of the construction of that line, and it's turned out to be the bright and shining star in the whole system. Recession or not, that Blue Line has been a real engine for economic development, and it's exceeded ridership projections remarkably. So can it be argued, can't you just point to that and say, see, that's what can happen if we just do this?
Absolutely. I think it is interesting that we talk about transportation in terms of moving people, but the biggest aspect of that is the economic development that it spurs as a part of that. There's well over $1 billion of investment along that first corridor in the Blue Line, and we expect the same thing to continue on the extension.
Of course, so, when you build these things, the apartments will come, we have discovered, and that, you know, not everybody living in those apartments are going to ride the train because they don't need to go where the train goes. They need to go someplace else. Doesn't that increase road congestion? Hasn't the Blue Line actually increased congestion?
Well, and I think – I'm sorry. One of the things that we face is that allowing for that to come in, we always have that conversation. Isn't it going to increase congestion? Well, they're coming to this region anyway, and it's all about trying to figure out how we can better site them and find a location where they have more choices. You know, our previous mantra in the 80s and 90s is let's push apartments as further out as possible. Keep them away from places. Now we finally understand that the value of bringing them close in creates economic development and gives people viable choices that they're really willing to pay more for.
Mm. Go ahead, Mary.
I think one of the pieces of the transportation system that people don't talk about a whole lot is pedestrians, mm-hmm. because that if you live in an apartment and you can't use the Blue Line, if you could still walk to your work or walk to the store or walk for any one of the however many daily trips people make, 10 or 12 per household, you're going to be producing less congestion than you would otherwise.
Well, let's talk about that, because on those 10,000 apartments that go up and down South Boulevard now, and there are more to come, and there'll be more to come as you go north with the Blue Line, are developers being asked to, mandated to, are they doing it on their own at all, putting in retail, grocery stores, dry cleaners, restaurants on the street level, places to walk to, or is it just a bunch of apartment buildings?
I think they are putting in some things, but I don't think they are as required as they ought to be to put in more retail space. You have to wait for the market. You know, if there's enough people, a dry cleaner will want to be there. But you've got to have space for the dry cleaner to be.
I know that the streetcar is a city project and that Katz simply runs it. It wasn't something that Katz proposed or even particularly wanted, but you're running it. Will we see the kind of development along the streetcar line, if we can build it out, or even if we can't, even if it just runs from where it starts and stops today, will we see the kind of development along that corridor that we've seen along the Blue Line?
Absolutely. I think, and I'm not going to try and, guess how much development, but already when we're talking about the next phase of the streetcar extension, we're already talking with developers who are in the process of developing both multi-use, multi-family apartments and retail, but also there are developers along the corridor who are reevaluating and changing their plans because of that investment.
Does the density that light rail has brought and will continue to bring and that the streetcar may bring, does that density obviously it helps in terms of economic development, helps in terms of the tax base, and it changes the character of a city. But does it pay off in the long run, or are we just creating more density?
I think it pays off in the long run. If you look at the projections for infrastructure costs and infrastructure maintenance, I mean, it's cheaper to use the sewer lines that are already there than to be building brand new sewer lines. I don't know, maybe Ned can talk about how much it cost to put sewer in at Ballantyne, but I'm thinking it was probably a lot. And if you can use the sewer lines that are already there, you've saved money mm-hmm. right there.
And we have this interesting study where we've got 10,000 or more folks that have moved into the South Boulevard corridor along the light rail line. But South Boulevard hasn't shut down. Mm. It still functions more or less okay. But if we put 10,000 people up in Huntersville or down in Matthews, it will grind the system to a halt because we don't have any more choices out in those areas.
And you say that we need a more complex mobility network that is more robust than just a highway solution.
Right. I think we have to look at all modes, and what we've been talking about this morning is it gives us multiple choices to be able to get around. And density helps that in the right locations. It's not just about putting density on the green fields. It's about being very intentional about where we put that and marrying that up to a mobility system that understands how we move people around.
And does these plans, this system that we're trying to develop, is it just Charlotte, or does it not have to include, Mary, the Ring Cities? Does it not have to include Matthews and Mint Hill?
I think it absolutely should include them and should include counties outside of Mecklenburg as well. But we were talking at the break about the plan, and I would say there is no the plan. All of those places have different plans. And until we have some unified regional entity that can at least look at all the different plans and say, wait a minute, you know, your plan over here in, you know, Gaston County or whatever doesn't really match up with this plan over here. Let's figure out how to make those match. But we don't have that right now.
Well, given the fact that we have organizations like the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute and we have all these plans, and Charlotte has been relatively forward-thinking in terms of trying to move the city along and being progressive and not set in its ways and accommodating growth, why don't we have an organization like the Council of Governments in Washington, D.C. that deals with three states, essentially?
I think, this can get teeth-grindingly boring in terms of policy, but there are these things called COGS, and there are these things called MPOs, and in a whole lot of places, the metro region has one entity, which is the combined COG and the combined MPO, but when they were set up in North Carolina—
Council of Governments is a COG.
Yeah,
what's
sorry.
An MPO?
A Metropolitan Planning Organization.
Okay, all
right. And it's actually transportation. When they were all set up in whenever it was, the 60s or the 70s, you know, North Carolina, Charlotte was not the dominant city in the state. It was one of a number of cities. And so there's all these little COGs and little MPOs, and they've never joined together because if you're in Gaston County, you don't want to be joined with Charlotte because Charlotte will suck up all the money for I-77 or whatever.
Right.
So it's a great point, and I talked earlier about we have a long way to go, but we've come a long way. So you're right, the federal government requires areas to create these metropolitan planning organizations. In the Charlotte area, there are some 24+ jurisdictions that are included there, from Huntersville, Cornelius, up to Iredell County now. And that's about air quality. That's your air quality envelope, so that as you're making transportation planning decisions, it has to make sure that you're doing things that are good from an air quality standpoint, as well as planning. So, for example, it wasn't that long ago you could just kitchen sink it. You could say, this is everything we want over the next 40 years. Today, there is a financial constraint. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you want to submit a plan today as you get into a tighter window, you've got to demonstrate that you can pay for it. So that makes it far more realistic.
I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because we've done several programs on this topic, and you were on one of them, Ned, to talk about the I-77 toll road. But let's just talk about it for a second because it's still a point, a bone of contention, and there are people still trying to put a stop to it. When you were on last time, I think we were talking about how the fact it is too late to reverse course. There'd be hundreds of millions of dollars in fines, et cetera. Aside from the fines, why is it true that it's too late to stop that?
Well, construction has started. At this point, you're literally inside now 3 years of literally driving on a 26-mile improvement. But this goes to the earlier conversation to take it a little bit away from I-77, which is the challenge of change. Mm-hmm. So as we try to bring systems, the I-77 project is about choice. It's about a predictable corridor that you're going to have that you know you can go in there and move at a certain speed. So when we talked about lifestyle components and all the different modes, we want bike, we want ped, we want greenway systems, we want transit systems. We also want within the highway concept a predictable travel time. And so managed lane means that when you're driving on that entrance ramp and you're coming down and you're wondering is there going to be a backup on the highway or what have you, all of a sudden you're going to know that there's at least one lane that is moving at 45 miles an hour.
But give me a 60-second crash course in how this happened, because it seemed to creep up on a lot of people. It was a done deal, a fait accompli, before anybody seemed to know about it. And when they found out about it, they thought, what the heck is this? Was it foisted on us by your organization? Was it foisted on us by Raleigh? Or was it a product of the Charlotte Region Transportation Planning Organization, which is a local organization? And if so, whoever did it, why didn't local leaders and business people know about it?
Well, they did.
Why didn't they talk about it?
Well, they did.
They're suddenly against it. Why weren't they against it all the way through the process?
So as early as 2009, the MPO that we were – Charlotte's MPO, the Charlotte Region's MPO, adopted the concept of managed lanes. And then in virtually each year since then, they have had one or more votes to further the progress of this congestion management strategy called managed lanes, which includes a tolling component. The MPO has all of these jurisdictions represented. Some of the people that are opposing the project today were on the MPO and voted to advance
the management. So is this politics? Is because they're hearing from their constituents and they don't want it, and now they're reacting to it?
And the constituents are the folks who haven't been that involved, and this is change, and it's uncomfortable for them.
So I-77's toll lanes are not the only toll lanes planned. They're coming to 485. They're coming to Independence Boulevard. They're coming to I-77 south of Charlotte. Would that be from where? To the South Carolina line?
Well, that is not a project that is done yet.
Why not?
That's a great question. For the first time, the I-77 project from the state line up to the Central Business District is now in the 10-year plan. It's actually planned out in the 10th year for that, and that allows us to now have serious planning around right-of-way acquisition, environmental concerns. It's the cost. It's estimated today at $1.2 billion, and that's just a prohibitive number.
So as you said, the state, I believe, and the MPO have adopted a policy of promoting toll or managed lanes on existing roadways. Why the sudden need for toll roads? We built a highway system without a single toll for 100 years. Why all of a sudden? Why
the federal government paid 90% of that.
And we've only been building the interstate system since the 50s. So it is relatively recent in our transportation history and how we do that. And I think that what we've seen is that in trying to protect our investments, we're working with dwindling tax dollars to do
that. And why is that?
Well, I think the biggest issue is that our where we get our money to build roads is based on a gas tax, which is based on a set of assumptions that are dwindling that number.
So as the price of gasoline goes down, as fuel efficiency increases, as electric cars and hybrids take more of the roads, mm-hmm. The revenue coming in from that stream is going to reduce even more.
That's right. That's right. Well,
that revenue base hasn't changed in 20-plus years.
Meaning?
The rate structure hasn't changed since the 80s, early 90s.
I think the federal gas tax has not been raised since 1993.
Yeah. I think you're right about that. Yeah. So why? If we know we have a decreasing gasoline consumption and we know we have lower gasoline prices and the tax is based on the price – and we haven't changed the price, the taxes since 1993, and we have tremendous infrastructure needs, mm-hmm. why not raise the gas tax and spread out the pain as opposed to just pinpointing it on toll roads around the area?
Raising the gas tax is part of the solution. At the state level, some 60% of our revenues for transportation originate from the gas tax. At the federal level, it's 92%.
And how has South Carolina been able to build these remarkably wide roads to nowhere, essentially, because although they'll be there when the people come, and we haven't?
Well, South Carolina actually is in a desperate need to reform their transportation systems. Last year, they tried to do a $700 million increase through gas tax increases and otherwise, and it failed to get through the legislature, so they did some stopgap measures. But I think South Carolina would say it is a crisis for them in terms of having to figure out how
Everyone talks about I-77 South in South Carolina. Right. Oh, well, they were able to build that out to God and infinity. But they taxed themselves to do it. So it was a sales tax that they imposed upon themselves a decade or more.
Let's take a break. We're going to talk some more about all this in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and NC Warn, offering opportunities for civic engagement in its Emergency Climate Response, a new campaign to help slow the climate crisis. Information at ncwarn.org. And Duray Construction, a commercial construction firm creating grand openings for regional clients for more than 15 years. Duray Construction, DOERRE, construction.com. Donald Trump's call to ban Muslims from entering the U.S. has touched off a rift within the Republican Party. So on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes, they talk about what the split between the base and party leaders means for the future of the Republican Party and the 2016 presidential race. That's coming up at 10. If you'd like to join our conversation, reach us at WFAE through Facebook or Twitter, or email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. We're coming back with more traffic plans in a moment.
I'm WFAA General Manager Joe O'Connor. On behalf of everyone here, let me wish you a safe and happy holiday season. We know that you have countless options for news, on air and online. Thank you for choosing WFAE. We hope you'll support us with a tax-deductible contribution of any amount before midnight, December 31st. Please visit WFAE.org to find out more. And thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about transportation and the transportation system that we're trying to create and build out between the toll roads and light rail and streetcars and buses and new roads and walkable, bikeable areas with Ned Curran, who's the chair of the North Carolina Board of Transportation, Mary Newsom, Associate Director of Urban and Regional Affairs at UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute. Craig Lewis is a principal at Stantec and an urban planner. And John M. Lewis, Jr. is CEO at CATS. One more comment on the gasoline tax before we move on, because it is a declining resource and will be going into the future. It's not coming back. Is that what you're saying?
It's a dinosaur. I mean, Toyota announced that by 2030, they're going to be completely switching over to fuel cell cars and electric. So we're rapidly going to see this argument about how much we're going to tax gasoline become irrelevant. And we've got to think about radically different structures in how we fund transportation systems.
Now, you say that adding free lanes, which is what people advocate now, to congested highways like I-77 is like throwing money down a rat hole. That is your quote. You also say that because they work, you are in favor of the toll project, but that it won't make any difference because we need more choices, not predicated on accommodating single-occupancy vehicles on single-purpose freeways. So what is the alternative to that? Because we can't seem to get commuter rail from Huntersville, which would take some cars off the road.
Right. And I think it's a layering. It's what we've been talking about. It's not just one solution to be able to address this. Part of the problem we have in many of our highways is that they are commuter roads and they're also local roads. Up in the north area, I happen to live up there. And it's hard to get across Lake Norman, so we have few choices in our overall system. So lots of people jump on to 77 and jump off one exit. And so that's part of the problem is it's not working the way it needs to because we don't have as many choices going up and down.
And so part of this project, and again, we'll keep this at a high level, but part of it is about choice. In other words, we're trying to provide another choice. A key component of the managed lane concept is this notion that they will adjust the pricing to ensure that at a minimum it's moving at 45 miles an hour. Now, why is that important? It's important to John because CATS buses will use that lane for free. Mm-hmm. And so you will have a bargain with the consumer that says if you want to ride uptown until we can get commuter rail in, the red line in, you can jump on this and you know you'll be in that expressway moving at that speed.
I want to move on from toll roads, but I want to touch on one more aspect of this that really has people hot and they really don't understand it, and even I don't. I'm scratching my head about this. Somebody has chosen a private partner to run this for 50 years. The Spanish company, Cintra, they will run it for 50 years. Is that a defensible decision?
It's an essential decision because when we look at our funding and we look at our needs, we have enormous gaps. In the Charlotte region alone, in Mecklenburg County, over the next 25 years, we are $12 billion short of maintaining a working system, $12 billion short. At the statewide level, we're in the $40 to $50 billion range. We have to have other resources, other money come into this system, and we have to do that through public-private partnerships. When we look at our transit system, and we talked earlier about the challenges we have in funding it, advancing it, we know we have to have other partners at the table.
But the argument here is that for 50 years, we will not be able to widen that road if we need to because it will impact Cintra's revenues if we do so, and they'll stop it.
Well, that's not true at all. We DOT, have the right to do anything we want to do within that corridor. There is a provision that says if we impair their revenues, we may have to pay them something for that. That's okay. That's just a cost to us. You know, the cost to cut a road through a mountain, the cost to put a bridge, all of the different projects we see across the state have different cost elements. The fact that there may be a provision.
Why not run it yourself?
Because then we have to come up with $600 or $700 million, and we don't have that much money to put into one project. So
right.
In this case, it's under $200 million.
We live in a conservative state that likes to keep money close to the vest. Excuse me. And we heard a lot of conservative voices opposing the Blue Line. We've heard a lot of conservative voices opposing these toll roads. Texas is a very conservative state as well. But, Craig, you point out that they have managed lanes everywhere. And more interestingly, Dallas, Texas, over the last 20 years, has built 90 miles of light rail with 62 stations accommodating 100,000 passenger trips a day, which is about what I-77 handles. How did they do it?
Well, I mean, they decided that they really had to do a different approach to their mobility system. Their first line was incredibly contentious. And I remember going out there almost 20 years ago and riding that up to the north part of the city, and it was a challenge for them. But once they got that first one going, they were able to build all those other elements out to the airport and really all throughout their city. And they did it because they taxed themselves. I mean, their system now, they rely very little on federal and state help. It's all largely local sales tax and revenues that they generate. It's one of the most conservative states. It is a state that has the Texas Transportation Institute, which is largely a roads-only focused think tank. But they recognize that a place like Dallas that's growing just like we are, I mean, Dallas is 20 years ahead of us, but they're making investments into their future because they want to remain economically competitive.
And John, you're the head of CATS, and I know you just got here in September, but I'm sure you've been in transit for a long time in your professional life. If you could do whatever you wanted to do, knowing what you know about Charlotte, if you could do the master plan and you could get the funding, what would you do? What would you be building? What would you be working toward?
Well, the plan is already in place.
What would you do if, as the guy who knows transit?
I would not change anything. I would accelerate it. If I could find that pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, it would be to fund the plan that's already in place. It is a very well thought out plan, and we'll meet the needs of the region going into the future.
Does that plan, do you think, pay for itself ultimately? There's a cash outlay up front, but does it pay for itself ultimately?
Absolutely. I think you have to look at, when you're talking about that return on investment, you have to look broader than the fare box recovery. If you're looking for CATS as a public transit agency to be able to pay for its own operations strictly through the fare box, that's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the benefit to the region from economic development and an increased tax base, I think the return on that investment will more than outweigh the expenditures.
And some people will say that's why we shouldn't have public transit because it's subsidized. Why should we subsidize people's trips? We subsidize roads, don't we?
Yeah, we subsidize every element of transportation. I mean, the notion that anything is free, I hear people talk about free lanes, and I scratch my head and I go, I've not seen a budget yet on a road project that was free. But in addition to the economic development, it's about quality of life. It's about giving people choices and having communities where people want to live.
Commuter rail is part of the package here of the system, ultimately, that we would like to have. The commuter rail to Huntersville has run into some stumbling blocks, among them the fact that Norfolk Southern doesn't really want to share the rail line that's already there, and lack of funding. Is part of a problem. But CATS and NCDOT have come up with a plan to fund the line through local property tax growth and fees. What has happened to that?
Well, the bigger challenge we have is working with the freight operators. You talked about Norfolk Southern, the challenge we have on the commuter line there, the challenge we have on passenger rail to the airport, using the line that Norfolk Southern is using to get to the multimodal facility. The freight operators, you know, they have their lines, and they really don't want it to go.
And so building our own track is out of the question because it's
too
expensive?
It is not out of the question. That's what we're going to have to do. We're going to have to acquire the right-of-way, which is what we're going to do for the Gateway Station, or use existing right-of-way and build parallel tracks far enough away from the freight to not disrupt their operation.
This is where I think one of the things – we have an opportunity to rethink the thoughts that we had 15 and 20 years ago. So 15, 20 years ago in the North Corridor, we were talking about commuter rail because it was low density and it was quick to do and we can get a real quick win. We can't do that now. So what I would challenge us to do as a community is actually go back and think about that. And the lesson from Dallas is Dallas ran light rail the same distance we're talking about running commuter rail. Mm-hmm. And it has been enormously successful. And one of the things I've written about is State Farm and their decision to relocate their $1.2 billion headquarters building in the Texas area along the light rail station on that long, we'll say long in quotes, light rail line. that in Charlotte would be a commuter rail line that would never generate that level of investment.
Mm. Charlotte had streetcars until 1938, mm-hmm. and there was this trend beginning in the 30s to get rid of streetcars.
Streetcars that were privately owned.
and replace them with buses. And I read yesterday that that was primarily because of the rise of the automobile and pressure from General Motors, who not only wanted to sell cars, they wanted to sell buses.
Buses, yep. Yes.
So Washington, D.C., Charlotte, other cities got rid of streetcars. Well, now we're bringing the streetcar back. We had free jitneys that went along that line. We have buses that go along the road where the streetcar is currently in place. Why do we need a streetcar? What will that streetcar do that buses and the free jitneys haven't been doing?
Well, I think, again, getting back to that economic development option, we've got to think about our choices in that more than just the mobility options that we're providing. Yes, bus can get you or jitneys can get you from point A to point B. But when you're trying to get that overall return on investment, it is the permanence of rail that attracts that investment. And so when we're talking about getting that ROI, we've got to talk about it in much more broader base than just the mobility options mm-hmm. we're providing. We want to incent. We want to provide a community that others want to invest in. And there's nothing greater than the permanence of rail that will attract that investment.
Another piece of this that I know is very close to Mary's heart is bikeability, walkability. And we've been building stretches of greenways. The initial greenway was kind of viewed with skepticism by some, and they tore that big parking lot up at what used to be Midtown Shopping Center. And now it's become this amenity that everybody is excited about because they use it for exercise. They use it because it's pretty. They use it just to commune with nature, and they're now using it to get from place to place. But how big a part of a transportation plan is walkability outside of the downtown core and bikeability?
I think they're key. I don't think you can have any type of a system unless you have a place where people can get places where they're not in their car. And whether they're getting to the transit station at I-45 in Pineville, I don't know. You got to be able to get there and not drive. Charlotte does not at this point have a pedestrian plan. I talked to Scott Curry just this morning to find out where we are. He says 2016 they're going to do a new transportation action plan, a new bike. They're going to update the bike plan, and they're going to create finally a pedestrian plan. So I think movement is afoot, to use a bad pun. But we could use that system of greenways more strategically than we have. Right now, they're where they are because it's all in floodplains and the land couldn't be developed on anyway, so people are okay to donate it. We're going to have to put some money into connecting it to places that aren't in floodplains where the people live.
Right. And there is a plan to connect them all together in this Carolina Thread Trail, which we've talked about many times, and that actually is kind of neat. And Charlotte has been putting bike lanes on surface roads. I think when they repave them, certain roads are automatically given bike lanes, but we've done a couple of shows on this, and making a place bikeable is more than painting a line down the street and putting a little symbol on the road. There's more to it than that. How are we approaching that part of it?
I think very slowly. There's been this sort of revolution in bike lane planning in the last 10 years that Charlotte just hasn't jumped on, and that's something called a protected lane.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they did it in New York. It's like one of those slap yourself on the forehead, why didn't we think of this 100 years ago, where you have your travel lane, and then instead of having your bike lane and then your on-street parking, you reverse it, and you have your travel lane and your on-street parking, and then your bike lane, which is then protected from the traffic, takes up no more space. You've protected your bike lane. It's like wheels on luggage. You know, why didn't we think of this long ago? And they haven't done that in Charlotte, and I don't know why. I don't know what the impediment to that is. So there's some new things that we could be doing that I hope we'll start doing.
Let me bring very, very quickly some comments in from listeners. How do planners rationalize spending hundreds of millions of dollars on light rail projects, yet huge areas of Mecklenburg County have no bus service? An example is the Plaza extension, which has no bus service. John.
That's a fantastic comment. It is absolutely true. But I'd say we have a list of priorities that we're checking off one at a time. The light rail has been, Blue Line has been a fantastic success, has exceeded all of our projected ridership, and we've talked about the economic development, but there are other needs in the system, and we've got to continue to address those. Unfortunately, at the end of the day, it gets down to the funding.
John, on Twitter, it seems the most obvious and useful light rail line would be from the airport to downtown. Why is this not being discussed? That seems like an absolute no-brainer to me.
You know, it seems like a no-brainer.
And it should go through downtown to South Park.
Yeah, the reality is that our airport is remarkably close to our central business district when you compare us to places like Denver and Dallas and other places. So, I would love to see rail to the airport. But I also understand that close of proximity, Uber, other choices, a lot of folks are going to use that.
I haven't seen a lot of recent studies, but 10 years ago or so, I mean, in order to get federal money, you've got to qualify for through some funding formulas, and you've got to have a certain amount of density along the line in the west. The line out to the airport didn't have that density at that time.
Tom says, I haven't heard anything about expanding I-77 beyond exit 28 in Cornelius. How far will the toll lanes go? And Michael on Twitter, why is Asheville getting 8 lanes and I-77 is getting toll lanes?
Because this region, since 2009, has said that's the choice we want. And when we talked about planning earlier, it takes a long time to put these plans in place.
Is that why it's important to vote in local elections, things like this?
Absolutely.
If more people had voted, we wouldn't have toll lanes?
The members on that planning organization, other than 2 DOT board members, are all elected officials.
Okay. So what about the first part of that? Any plan to expand? How far will the toll lanes go up I-77?
It's north of the causeway. It's up past Davidson.
Mm-hmm. And Joe says, have we considered a commuter tax for South Carolina residents who work in North Carolina to help fund transportation projects in the Charlotte region, or even a toll lanes coming out of South Carolina on 77?
Yeah, toll lanes on 77 would capture some of that.
Have we thought about that?
Absolutely.
Are we going to do that?
Are they toll lanes or are they guard gates?
I think the commuter tax idea is not very popular with anybody outside of Mecklenburg County.
Sure.
So, Ned Curran is chair of the North Carolina Board of Transportation, Greg Lewis, principal at Stantec, John Lewis, CEO of CATS, and Mary Newsom, associate director of urban and regional affairs at the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte.